Welcome to the Allworth International Lecture Series, recorded live at the University of Minnesota Duluth. KUMD and the Allworth Institute for International Studies are pleased to bring you tonight, The Trump Administration and the Future of Diplomacy. Presented here by Thomas Hansen, Allworth Institute, diplomat in residence and retired U.S. Foreign Service officer, along with Dr. Paul Sharp, professor and head of the UMD Political Science Department, co-editor of Palgrave's Diplomacy and International Relations series and Hague Journal of Diplomacy. Allworth director Cindy Christian welcomes the audience to the Weber Music Hall and opens the evening with the question, what is diplomacy? Dr. Sharp starts us off here tonight.
Diplomacy is essentially negotiation. And negotiation is another word for diplomacy, and diplomacy is a word for negotiating. So whenever you end up negotiating with somebody, you are, of a sort, engaged in diplomacy. A good colleague of mine at the University of Cyprus says that diplomacy is about the representation of interests and ideas, and that diplomats are very much involved in building the international world in which we live through their actions, through their words, through symbolism, that they actually make the international world. It isn't anywhere else except in the words and actions of people doing diplomacy. And I'm nearly finished on this, Cindy, I swear. Is how does diplomacy do what it does? We have an idea that diplomacy is a way of conducting relations. We've all used the phrase being diplomat, being diplomatic, being a good diplomat. We all know people who we think are good diplomats. We all know people who we think are absolutely awful at diplomacy in the ways they handle their relations. Ernest Satow, who wrote the Bible on 19th century diplomacy, said that diplomacy is the application of intelligence and tact to the conduct of official relations between governments of independent states. Intelligence and tact, you can see the trouble we're going to get into later on. A good place to start thinking about diplomacy is to think in terms of that old sociology, in groups, out groups. The relations inside groups, the relations between groups. And the relations between separate groups having a different character from relations within groups. I think that's a useful starting point. And then if you take that as your starting point, you're forced to concede that there will always be diplomacy. It's not a question of whether there's diplomacy or no diplomacy. What it really comes down to is a question of there's better diplomacy and there's worse diplomacy in the way we conduct our relations between different groups. And it says here in my notes now, ask Tom if he wants to add anything.
I'm just going to do that. Tom, do you want to add anything?
Well, I don't know what I could add. I think Paul really summed it up beautifully. Just anecdotally, a former colleague of mine at the State Department always used to refer to diplomacy as a splendid seat on stage at the theater of life. Now, we have a lot of theater going on right now. There's no question about that in the administration. I'm not sure that the seat for diplomats is on stage anymore. I think at least temporarily, it's kind of back in the cloakroom. There's a lot of problems going on at the State Department right now, as I'm sure you've read about. It's very unclear what the role of diplomacy is, what the administration's approach to diplomacy will be. If you look at the art of the deal, which is a kind of a roadmap, perhaps, for Trump's way of thinking, he kind of describes his negotiating style in two steps. The first step is you up the temperature, you act somewhat irrationally, you rattle everyone's cage, you prepare the ground that way, and then you negotiate, having softened up. Just on diplomacy in general, I think, you know, it's the management of relations traditionally between independent states. I mean, mm-hmm. ever since the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, we've been living in world of nation states. We still are. Other regions like Catalonia, Scotland want to become states still. It's a popular thing. Trump is, in his speeches, both in Warsaw and just recently, is stressing the nation state, that we respect other states, so it's almost like we're returning to this concept. And I've always thought, just as I practiced this career, that the Where you start is trying to understand as best as you can the reasoning behind the person you're negotiating with, the country you're negotiating with, the reasoning behind their own perception of their own interests. You get as clear a view of that as you can, because what you want to do is to change their calculation of their own interests. That's what diplomacy is. It's trying to persuade people to move in your direction in the way they define what's in their interest, enlightened interest or otherwise. Therefore, you can't do that without understanding other countries on their own terms. And that's exactly what U.S. diplomacy has lost in recent times, if it ever really had it. We've just been through a period of what they call transformational diplomacy. I'll talk much more about that later. The idea that the goal of U.S. diplomacy is to change countries, to make them more democratic, which is a laudable goal. But we've stepped back from this idea of kind of going into their skin, trying to see how they see their interests, because, frankly, that's the best way we can influence other countries, in my view. And I firmly believe we have to get back to that concept of diplomacy that we have progressively lost in recent decades.
Are there different forms of diplomacy?
Yeah, there certainly are. If you look at the way different human communities practice diplomacy, you can say that diplomacy takes its shape from the properties of the actors, whether they're, for example, bands, tribes, or states. The Ojibwe and the Lakota in northern Minnesota would enter into negotiations with each other. For example, in wintertime, they'd agree not to beat each other up in each other's hunting grounds. They'd say, life's hard enough for all of us, so let's organize a truce. And they would negotiate a series of issues in these terms. We don't quite know how, but we do know that these conversations took place between them. And so we can see a very different form of diplomacy there, dependent on the types of actors. Diplomacy also changes in terms of reflecting the material technologies and the social technologies that are available to human communities, particularly obviously regarding travel, how to get from one place to another. In the classical era, diplomatic missions took years for a complete round through travel to one end and then back to the other to deliver messages. And of course, communication technologies we see now are vitally important to how diplomacy is conducted. And we actually, especially the experts, do not know what's happening. With the rise of social media and various communication platforms and the impact these are having on diplomacy and the use that diplomats and others are making of them. We're very much feeling our way, I suppose, in those terms. Three images, the homogenous European modern system, call it modern as well as European, so 18th, 19th century, it was a very small club of men. They spoke the same language, had the same upbringing, same understanding. They were insulated from politics, and they applied their expertise to managing the states and the sovereigns who they represented. Early 20th century, the United States comes onto the world stage and insists on a sort of parliamentary form of diplomacy, where diplomacy looks more like politics carried on through institutions rather than these discrete negotiations of experts. And now we have, I'm going to throw out the usual words, we've got a networked world. States seem to have a very uncertain position within this. At least there's a lot of other stuff going on. Some people talk about a post-state world emerging, but at the same time we seem to be going back to the future in many respects. I'll talk about that in a little bit. I'm going to give you a list. Those of you who take notes, this is the easy part here. We're talking about different types of diplomacy. There's a term for this, hyphenated diplomacies, these different diplomacies. Some of them will be familiar to you. Economic diplomacy, commercial diplomacy, that's different. Public diplomacy, talking directly to people instead of government to government. And some of you will be old enough to remember ping pong diplomacy. And there have been other sorts of sports-related diplomacies, and in fact something called sports diplomacy now exists. Sport to improve relations of nations, but the sheer processes and negotiations that it takes to put on the Olympics or a World Cup, something in those terms. More recently, Hillary Clinton was very interested in something called digital diplomacy. There is celebrity diplomacy, where movie stars go off to places in crisis and try and have an impact. There's now food and culinary diplomacy, where culinary traditions are used to promote interests and values. Citizen diplomacy, anybody from Duluth knows about citizen diplomacy and the role of ordinary citizens in getting engaged in international relations. And I've written about something called internal diplomacy and domestic diplomacy, at which point I thought, well, we're pretty close to emptying the concept of any meaning whatsoever. Types of diplomacy seem to be proliferating in the world at the moment. And I'd almost suggest that what they have in common is getting harder and harder to identify. What is the core that makes us want to use the word diplomacy of all these different forms of diplomacy that we talk about? Yeah.
What role has diplomacy played in U.S. foreign policy over the years?
I will be very brief. It's kind of a softball for Tom to take up. It is... people who are interested in diplomacy customarily make a distinction between diplomacy on the one hand and foreign policy and sometimes statecraft on the other. Harold Nicholson, who I mentioned already, was the big man in making this sort of distinction. And what they're trying to get at here is the idea that diplomats are responsible for carrying out policy. Or they're one of the ways in which to carry out policy. And diplomats are also responsible for advising and helping to make foreign policy from the front end, if you like, of the process. But they do not actually make the decisions. There's the identification of foreign policy as the choices about what to actually do in the world. So the diplomats particularly make this argument when they're under pressure and getting told off when things have gone wrong. Hey, we're just doing what we're told to do. It's a version of carrying out orders in some ways. And here's the jump over to Tom. The United States has always resisted this distinction between diplomacy and foreign policy, and argues from a very historical conception of diplomacy as something European, something cynical, something corrupt, and something not honest, and is built from there.
What is President Trump's perspective on diplomacy, and how has he used it in the first year of his presidency?
The application of intelligence and tact to relations of states. Why did Sathau stress that? The key assumption was that the relations of states and their sovereigns, which in the days of the setting up of the modern system were sovereigns, kings, queens, with personalities and egos. We're glad we've moved so far away from that these days. But the idea was it was a dangerous business in which there were always great chances for misunderstandings. And the key thing for diplomacy was to avoid unwanted or accidental, unintentional conflict. People often equate diplomacy with necessarily peaceful activity, that it's always searching for peace. It's not the case at all. You can have the diplomacy of building up war coalitions. You can have the diplomacy of cornering a state that you want to get to conform to your foreign policy objectives. But the point was to get away from making mistakes and misunderstandings. And hence they developed this huge code of communication where they understated things, they said things very politely, and in addition to intelligence and tact, Tom's already touched on a couple of these. People say good diplomats, interestingly enough, they don't need first-class minds. They don't need to be really, really, really clever. Really, really clever people trouble. But they have to be clever in the sense of empathy and capable of understanding what other people want in a good way, but also to learn the other fellow's game. They stress moderation in behavior and language. They stress restraint, and particularly self-restraint, as indicators of good diplomats and good diplomacy. And the purpose of all this is to establish two things, reputational credit, that your counterparts will look at you and admire you, and above all, and there's the second thing, that they will trust you. They might not like what you're going to say, but they will realize you're serious. They'll realize that you've made an effort to understand what they are interested in. And it's in that context, I suppose, that we try to make some sort of assessment of President Trump so far. I was talking to a colleague actually at Clingendale this morning, and he said, and Tom I think has already touched on, he said, the thing with Trump is what you see all there is, or is there more going on? When we look at Trump, is he bouncing around like a ping pong ball? Or is he crazy like a fox, method in his madness? And I don't think we know the answer to that at this point. I think it could break and break in all sorts of directions. I'll say, I'm trying this out on you. President Trump is not all that new a phenomenon in international relations. In fact, modern diplomacy, as I've been talking about it, the European kind of diplomacy, was essentially, or in great part, established to control bad kings. Kings left to themselves would mess things up. They're used to being obeyed. They're used to being chief executives, for want of a better word, who, when they say what they want, it happens, but they're dealing in an environment which they don't that they don't control. So it's not a new problem in that sense. And I'd say further to that, sometimes acting like a bad king makes for very good diplomacy. Sometimes acting as if one is crazy, acting as if one is likely to do desperate things unless one gets satisfaction, is a well-established approach to statecraft. But here's what I'd say now. Be quiet. We've got this uncertainty about President Trump. We don't know what he is in all this. Is telling Tillerson to quit bothering, is it a very sophisticated, good, bad, cop, bad strategy, or is he just saying what comes into his mind and reacting to the immediate situation? But we've got this uncertainty at the same time as we're seeing all these big changes in international relations, that forward into the future of globalization, of social media, of the ability for us all to conduct instantaneous communication and be players, the huge difficulty in maintaining any kind of secrecy or discretion in relations now. And we're stuck also with the return of the 19th century. And great power politics coming back as the United States moves into relative decline, and where it increasingly struggles to maintain the commitment that it already has, and other states are starting, at least at the soft power level, to fill some of the gaps. We're back to the balance of power. That's what I think in some ways is fascinating for people who study diplomacy, is we kind of don't know which way this is going to break. If I can say very briefly about foreign policy, I think in terms of candidate Trump and the idea that the United States needs to change, I think the Trump revolution is already over. The blob, as we were hearing about it in Edinburgh, is well on the way to gobbling him up in terms of his ability to pursue innovative foreign policy. That, to me, intellectually, is disappointing. I was interested to see what was going to happen. On the other hand, the fact that he seems capable of making huge errors and mistakes and of judgment, that keeps things interesting, but not in a good way.
You know, following up on questions about his cabinet choices and what they say about his diplomatic approach, I think you've touched on that a bit. Is there anything either one of you want to add to that?
Well, okay, I'll just say briefly, many generals, but the problem is at the next level, which is where a lot of the staff work gets done and some of the real preparatory diplomacy, people have not been appointed. I mean, it's simply the State Department is kind of tumbleweeds or rolling through the halls. You've got, you know, working level people in the key positions. So that's been a big problem in getting a kind of steady diplomacy up. This may be just the fact that he is not going to give the State Department a very important role, and he'll do it a different way. I sometimes think that the Saudi royal family feels very comfortable dealing with the Trumps because it's a kind of a family dynasty. They're dealing with Ivanka and with Jared, and it's all very comfortable.
But the big fuss and the big shift of policy seem to revolve around sending 4,000 people to a place. And that, in the history of American foreign policy, is not a big decision. It is, I think, more of the same. The other, I suppose, although I think I might be on Tom's ground here, is not just in the United States, but elsewhere, the foreign policy bureaucracy is a bureaucracy. It's coping with information technology. It's increasingly, just like educational bureaucracies, medical bureaucracies, committing more and more resources to running itself rather than doing what it's supposed to be doing in terms of the people who represent the country, practice medicine and so forth. And this seems to be a huge process that nobody knows quite how to get a handle on. But that's a hobby horse of mine, so I'll stop right there.
Okay, what approaches to diplomacy have been used by previous presidents in comparison? I know, Tom, you touched on a couple of those. Do you want to expand upon that?
The previous administrations, especially the Obama administration, was, as I had said, much more multilateral in their approach. But I think that the turning point in modern diplomacy was at the end of the Cold War, the demise of the Soviet Union into 15 republics, and how should U.S. diplomacy operate? We were used to the Cold War with a clear enemy. As they said during the Cold War years, politics stops at the water's edge. You don't disagree on foreign policy. It's too important. We're facing this threat from the Soviet Union. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, it's like the world became demagnetized, and that included our consensus at home on foreign policy. One former colleague at State talks about an enemy deprivation syndrome that our country has at this point. There's nothing quite like the old Soviet Union on the horizon. You've got a rising China, yes, but it's a different thing. So I think that we fell into a diplomacy in the 90s, a very optimistic one based on expansion of the democratic space of the bringing, if we'd won the Cold War and if our values had prevailed, which we believe they had, and we were strongest militarily, why not expand the circle of democratic nations? And this this reflex turned into things like the expansion of NATO, which was done in a very optimistic spirit, and with after 9/11, this kind of a reflex then deepened into what at the time then was called transformational diplomacy. The idea that we face a threat of terrorism, the Bush administration defined that threat as an existential one, and said that it emanates from countries that are not free. That where the human heart is not free, you have the danger of terrorism. Therefore, it's the role of the U.S. for our own national security to try to help countries to become free. And so transformational diplomacy, Condoleezza Rice told the State Department at one point that the role of a diplomat under transformational diplomacy was not to negotiate or analyze a country, it is to transform it. And we had a huge initiative called the Global Repositioning Initiative during those years, where 300 positions were shifted out of more traditional diplomatic posts out to, frankly, areas that needed transforming. The Chinese refused to accept these diplomats. They saw the logic behind it. So that continued somewhat into Obama's time. He criticized, he talked about nation building at home, but in fact he didn't really depart too much from the consensus, and I think Hillary would have been very much about democracy promotion and using public diplomacy and other means to promote democracy accurately. So I think that's the stage that that Trump entered upon. That was the immediate sort of preceding diplomacy. And at least verbally, he's disavowing it. There's no question about that. And there's studies that came out. One, it's a joint Boston University, University of Minnesota Law School study that just came out. They went to Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, key districts that had swung heavily to Trump, and they found a common factor, and that was districts that had, since 9/11, borne the brunt of our military involvements with military families, and that this was a winning point for Trump, criticizing both parties on Iraq and saying, you know, we're not going to do that anymore, was a part of his coalition. He's saber-rattling, but he's not talking about democratization of other countries. In fact, Tillerson's being criticized for downplaying human rights, downplaying values in our foreign policy.
Paul, unless you want to add to that question, we can move on to your final thoughts, and we'll start with Paul and move to Tom, and while they are doing that, we'll start collecting your questions.
Well, stick to diplomacy rather than Trump and be very brief. The way diplomacy, as it was seen in this golden age of 18th century to 19th century Europe, operated was that you insulated a professional elite. You insulated from their leaders above, and you insulated from them from hoi polloi below, who could never possibly grasp the subtleties, difficulties, and complications of international relations. And they were allowed, as it were, plenty of room to function at their own speed, playing their own game. Critics will point out that delivered us 1914 in some respects, so we shouldn't have too golden the memory of that time. I think that the idea of insulating diplomacy again from all these turbulences and winds that buffet it from various points of view is an absolute non-starter. I can't get back there again. And that forces me to conclude with a very self-serving argument, which is that if people in general are going to be involved in international relations, and it seems that they are increasingly so, given the social and material technologies available to them to be players, then they have to learn diplomacy, and they have to become diplomats themselves. And that gives me a job, educating diplomats.
I'd just like to make a couple of final comments about U.S. diplomacy specifically, and it's not just all the political appointees that set us apart. I mean, our geography, our very unusual, blessed geography, where we have really no threats close at hand. Very few countries can claim that benefit, and there's a bit of a moral hazard to that, actually, when you think about it. Other countries compete, you know, with peer rivals in their own regions, and one of the goals of U.S. diplomacy has been to prevent any other country from dominating its own region the way we dominate ours. Trump is questioning that for the moment. So that is a very specifically American situation. The other is our system of government based on separation of powers. This separation between the Congress, the judiciary, and the executive branch when it comes to foreign policy has been called an invitation to struggle. There's a book by that title about especially the congressional role in foreign policy. Other countries find this, Paul mentioned the parliamentary input in the U.S., other countries find this very confusing. Because the Senate, especially, has power of the purse over spending on diplomacy. It approves treaties with a two-thirds vote. It approves ambassadorial appointments. And it is the body that declares war. Now, Congress has not been using that function recently. They've been not wanting to stick their necks out. So we're still, all the fighting we're doing in the Middle East right now is based on a post-9/11 resolution that has not been updated or amended. Everyone is still using that as the basic. The increasing role of Congress, especially after Watergate and Vietnam, where congressional staffs were greatly expanded, and Congress carved out a larger role for itself is a big factor. And my last point, we're seeing that right now in a very uncanny way. Trump is being blocked in many of his foreign policy initiatives by a Republican-controlled Congress. It's the same party. And yet on Russia, especially Russian sanctions, the Congress is acting on its own and binding the president. It's asserting itself. And this is also happening very eerily on State Department spending. The Trump administration has gone to Congress asking for 31% cuts in our diplomacy, and Congress is saying, no, we're not going to approve that. We're not going to let you cut the Fulbright program to that extent. So anyway, our invitation to struggle that's built into our system is taking very unusual forms right now.
Okay, well, I think we'll take this moment to thank them for these comments they've given us, and then we'll go to your questions. Okay, thank you very much. Normally, I take some time to look at these, but we'll start with the one at the top, and then I'll see what we have. Do we risk the demise of democracy when we assume our way is supreme? What makes American values superior to other values? And who would like to take that?
Can you go through that slowly again?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Do we risk the demise of democracy when we assume our way is supreme? What makes American values superior to other values? I don't think anyone said they were superior, just saying what they were, but if you want to comment.
That's a heck of a question. I'll stay in my diplomacy trench. And my first response to that is you may well believe, and other people may well believe, that their values are in some sense universal, apply to everybody or ought to apply to everybody. But it's not a good place to start if you're talking to other people. It's much better to start from a plural conception of the world and to assume that other people don't see things quite the way you do. Having said that, I think anybody who would seriously suggest that a lot of values associated with the United States, but also associated with lots of other countries in the world, have not proved attractive, I think that would be a very difficult argument to make. So that seemed to be some universal values sitting out there. The difficulty is in how we bring them about if we're that keen on them, and the diplomat would probably say, probably don't try too hard. You're likely to create more trouble than it's worth.
Sort of the U.S. approach to values was codified in the early UN law, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was a negotiated document, but very much, I think, reflected our views on values. And it's interesting that the UN is based, on the one hand, on Westphalia, the rights of states, non-intervention in internal affairs, sanctity of borders, a very much realist approach, and yet it has these aspirational human rights aspects to it. And so, and increasingly with examples of genocide in Rwanda and otherwise, other crises, the idea that states have a right to intervene in other states in certain circumstances, has a responsibility to protect, which was the doctrine that got us into Libya. So, some of these values have been operationalized over time, and not just by us, but in the UN. I come back to one basic point. I think it was Walter Lippmann who did, in the 1920s, an analysis of U.S. diplomacy. And the bottom line was a country will thrive, its democracy will thrive, as long as it keeps its ends and its means in balance. If you begin to aspire to ends that your means cannot uphold, then you risk potentially your democracy as well. And so I guess that's one question as we've gone in, you know, kind of a deficit spending mode. We've spent, perhaps, you hear varying statistics, but I mean, trillions of dollars since 9/11. outside of our borders. And during the Iraq War, the spending on Iraq was kept off budget. It was kept basically in a lockbox so that the population could not see how much was being spent. And I think that's a threat to democracy. You know, Immanuel Kant, looking way back in his pamphlet on perpetual peace, said that republics will always tend not to go to war because the population of a free republic will only in rare circumstances vote to expose itself to war. But two conditions had to be met. Number one, the entire population, including the elites, had to be exposed to military service. Now, that was true during Vietnam, the Ken Burns Vietnam documentary is underway. But right after Vietnam, we got rid of the draft for all time. Nobody will touch that again. And as a result, we failed that criterion. And the second point Kant made was, and he said there should be an international convention on this, no country at war should be allowed to run a deficit because it hides the cost from the population. So I guess that I would say that the ends and means issue is the one that can be a threat to a system.
Okay, we'll go to a policy question. And this one is asking for an analysis of Trump's approach to nuclear nonproliferation and if that's reflected in his statements about Iran and North Korea.
He has criticized, it's a mixed bag. You know, Obama signed certain nuclear weapons treaties with the Soviet Union, with Russia, rather. And Trump is not fundamentally calling into question that part of the relationship with Russia. He is talking more promiscuously, if you will, about the use of nuclear weapons. That is something presidents usually do not talk about. Now, Putin has been doing the same thing in Russia, kind of raising that under certain circumstances we're ready to use these weapons. And, of course, the North Koreans are doing the same. So that is a kind of it's an unfortunate mix in the nuclear equation. There's an arms race underway based on new types of nuclear weapons, dial-a-yield steerable nuclear bombs, high-velocity weapons, Mach 14, that will strike anywhere on Earth in 1 hour. These programs were sped up under Obama. They're going forward under Trump. And a lot of organizations like the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Carnegie, MacArthur Foundation are sounding the alarm about this new arms race because, frankly, our media is not covering it. I don't see Trump in any way questioning the direction we're under as it goes forward. I might just, as a brief aside, if I may, the MacArthur Foundation is about to launch a major initiative to sensitize the population about the arms race. And they hired a bunch of consultants about how best to do that. And they were told, look, the present generation doesn't do narrative. Don't even try. You can do, don't even do a documentary. It has to be an event. So the conservative MacArthur Foundation has come up with an event called The Bomb, which will probably be at the Walker before long. 30 screens, flashing images of nuclear weapons and a live rock band. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting.
He had a lot of plans for tonight that we wouldn't let him carry through with. So I just want you to offer a brief definition for us of the blob because people are asking what the blob is.
Remember Steve McQueen? No, the blob. Do you want to describe the blob?
The fugitive is always running away from it. The idea here, and you find it expressed in different ways, is that they're, I mean, an older phrase is a military-industrial complex. People on both the right and left talk about a deep state that exists below a kind of democratic veneer. And there is a combination of private and public power that is interested in maintaining the United States' position in the world. and doing it primarily, well, not exclusively, but primarily by military means, if necessary. They are committed to notions like U.S. leadership and engagement, and they will mold any leader towards this middle consensus. Doesn't matter what you come in talking. Obama came in talking about more diplomacy and withdrawing the United States military commitments in Afghanistan and Iraq, but despite his best efforts, he cannot do it, and actually he just about manages to get out of Syria, avoid getting involved in Syria, and there his own friends are mad at him for not getting involved, but can't keep out of Libya. Candidate Trump talks about, we don't have a dog in these fights, why are we constantly getting dragged off into these various situations? President Trump finds the inertial pressure, the constant drip, options presented to him as, well, Mr. President, if you try that, here's all the things that will happen, in a way that just weighs heavily against making a change. I think going back to nuclear weapons, and it goes back even further in the questions, I do think we have to at least think about the relationship between ideas, ideology, and power. It's not a simple one. There's not values and ideas over here and power over here, and they're somehow separate. You might like the ideas, but the ideas of the powerful tend to be the ones that get heard the most and get put forward. And we live in an international system now where power is becoming less centralized, less controlled, or distributed around the world. Bad time to be making arguments for universal ideas when there isn't the muscle or the wealth to sustain them. I also think governments tend to be not altogether honest about nuclear weapons. The formal commitment is, what a sad thing nuclear weapons are. Let's work our way to getting rid of them. The problem is one of trust. If only we could trust each other, we could get rid of them. I think governments that have acquired nuclear weapons, with the exception maybe of South Africa, tend to like them. They'll see how few of them they can get away with, but they like to keep them for all sorts of reasons. Like North Korea, they see them as life insurance. They see them as a badge of prowess, technical competence to their own people, if not foreigners. And I think in the end, they're not in such a great hurry to get rid of them. Margaret Thatcher famously said, it's a bad idea to get rid of nuclear weapons, they keep the peace. There would have been a war between the USSR and the United States without the presence of nuclear weapons. And if you get rid of them, you can't get rid of the knowledge of the damn things. And if tensions increase between great powers, states would race to reacquire nuclear weapons. And then she added, and the country that would win the race was the one that lied all along and kept them. So there's the trust problem of the best intentions, we don't want to get rid of them. But I think governments are about power, and I think they find them useful.
Okay, this is about China, and if you could comment on Trump's use of diplomacy with China, what you see in those interactions, and where it might be going.
So I'll take up. Paul has been in China recently, and I think we'll have the last word on this. As you may recall, there was a kind of a kerfluffle early on with Trump when he took a phone call from the president of Taiwan, which was probably not very diplomatic. He brushed it off and said, well, you know, we will link the One China policy to how China behaves on trade and on North Korea especially, which also shocked the Chinese, because in addition to this bilateral concept, I think Trump's foreign policy is also, yes, transactional. In other words, a business approach where you link one, you do this for me, I'll do that for you, without regard for how important certain of these linkages are. I mean, for the Chinese, the one China policy is sacrosanct, and not something they want to see linked to anything else. The other, I think, trend for Trump is that he's neo-mercantile. Not neoconservative anymore, neo-mercantile, the idea that he might start to try to protect our economy, whether with tariffs or import duties, whatever. So China is being caught up in that, and on the one hand, we're asking them to cooperate with us on North Korea. On the other hand, we're talking about their steel exports, other, you know, kind of threatening possible trade sanctions. And I think it's very confusing for the Chinese. They're not quite used to that approach. There are people in the administration, Peter Navarro being one, his book Death by China. Steve Bannon, when he was in, believed that the great threat now coming at us was China and the way they're dominating trade. This is different from the first two other schools toward China that preceded Trump. The first, which is sort of symbolized by Bob Zelig, the former head of the World Bank, we want to make China a stakeholder and engage them in the world economy, and they will transform, they'll be transformed in this process. And most of the American business community believes that. The second approach is one that's kind of epitomized by John Mearsheimer at Chicago. He wrote a book called The Tragedy of the Great Powers, and the idea that anytime you have a rising power like China, there's going to be war, and so therefore, even though China's behaving right now, we can't know how they'll be when they've risen, therefore we have to start hedging right now against China. And frankly, that mentality was taken up by the Obama administration. It's part of what's behind the pivot, the idea that China is emerging as a security threat. But this Trump approach is the third one. It's focused on trade and on China as an economic threat and very transactional. So the Chinese are pretty confused right now, I think, about all this.
One
image is China's the currency manipulator, China's the cheap, China is the foot dragger that won't take on its share of international responsibilities, particularly in putting the squeeze on North Korea. There's one image. The other image, I think, that we're getting fairly consistently is President Trump seems to be attracted to powerful men. He likes them. The Putin on-off relationship, but the same thing with Xi too, and he likes consorting with them. I think he's looking forward to his visit coming up. So he's pulled in those two ways. The other little snapshot I recall is him saying words to the effect of, "Well, we tried to push Xi to do something about North Korea, and he told me why he couldn't. And boy, isn't it complicated?" And I hadn't quite realised it was that complicated. I think the other thing, and this is a sort of just another impression to contrast with the impression of being in the United States. Tom was just saying there's that idea of trying to integrate China into the world, try to get it to become a responsible player, a bit like Henry Kissinger trying to get the USSR to be a player in the era of détente. I don't think the Chinese see it like that. I think there's a sign of the shift that you're seeing now. If you're over there, they're droning on and on about one belt, one road. They're frying their own fish. They're conducting relations with other countries where the United States is not considered to be a part of what's going on. So there isn't a world order which the United States is the senior player and others are looking for membership. I think we're seeing just the start of multiple orders, and those orders will reflect the priorities and values of the dominant players within them. And I think if there's one thing that Americans need to do and think about foreign policy is to continue to think we are just one very big player now, rather than obviously the leader. You hear over and over again the argument that America must lead, and the rest of the world wants us to lead. The rest of the world's not as sure as it was about that for a mixture of reasons. When America suggests as candidate Trump that we might stop leading, they all start to worry. But as Chancellor Merkel was saying the other day, we're not so sure about the United States now.
Tom. I agree 100% with what Paul said there. And just to add just a footnote, this One Belt, One Road initiative is emerging as probably the largest engineering project in human history. China's negotiated bilateral agreements with 70 countries, including most of our allies in Europe. We're talking 4.4 billion people that are involved. There's all kinds of contracts. And I met with somebody from the Commerce Department in Washington last week who expressed tremendous frustration that our Commerce Department is not allowed to get involved in this. We're not allowed to advise American companies or to encourage American companies to get involved because we're standing aloof. If it's not on our terms, we don't want China setting the agenda, setting the standards, and so we lobbied hard against our allies, telling them, don't join this. Well, they all have. And we're as Paul said, the world is kind of getting on with its business, and we're going to face more and more of these issues of whether to join in on things like this that aren't necessarily of our making. Probably the best way to influence this would be to get in and try to influence it from the inside because it's already underway. And what really is going to speed up this emergence of Eurasia as the fulcrum of the world economy is that other powers in the region are beginning to compete with the Chinese on this. India and Japan have now announced their own Silk Road Initiative, and they will put a lot of money. And so you're going to have competing powers trying to do this massive infrastructure. I wish we were doing this in our own region. I don't see why we can't do the same sort of thing in the Americas, rather than standing aloof with what people are doing in Eurasia.
Okay, we're kind of running out of time, so we're going to ask one more question that follows that, and then a question sort of about an issue area. But I also want to tell, I had Josh over here who has volunteered to help tonight check the score of the game. Tom was really concerned that you might be missing the Twins, and it was 3-3, top of the second. Okay.
Only top of the second. Okay, that's
yeah. It. Doesn't do you much good right now. But there were a couple questions about this bilateralism and how useful multilateralism is going to be facing problems such as climate change. But also what you were talking about, Tom, in terms of how we might act in our own hemisphere. Right?
Yeah. If you think about it, the threat that's out there, if we really think hard, is a threat to the planet and to the species. And it's a unifying threat if it's conceived properly, right? So, and that would argue for very much a multilateral approach. The Chinese have reaffirmed their commitment to Paris. Even though we've withdrawn from Paris, we're still observing it because the withdrawal period is a couple of years, as I understand it. So I think that the bilateral approach can only go so far. Now, this being said, China very much prefers a bilateral approach, too. I mentioned on the Silk Road, they're not dealing with the European Union. They are dealing individually with Germany, with Greece, where they're building a huge new port as part of the Silk Road, with Hungary. And so I feel sorry for the European Union, which is the great multilateral experiment of our time. The three large powers around them are approaching them in a way that would try to fragment them. Trump is all about bilateral and has questioned the European Union. China is coming in bilaterally, and of course Russia would very much like to disrupt the experiment. So, but I believe that the real challenges today are global, and we're going to have a multilateral outlook, personally.
Paul, do you want to add to that?
Very briefly, ask diplomats, and they tend to say all diplomacy is bilateral. That's the building blocks of anything, even in a multilateral setting, is one-on-one talks. I think a lot of political science, international relations hypotheses are going to be severely tested over the next few years. I take on board the argument that we face global challenges which have to be met globally or multilaterally. All my training makes me want to say you can't get there from here. All the incentives of the political orders that we've established are powerfully for defecting, for talking. This is one of the occasions where talk is cheap, but substantive commitments are very hard to achieve, and people can always be tempted to defect from them. So that's kind of a gloomy take on it. And the other is looking at my own country and its decision to try and leave the European Union. And I say try to leave because I think there's a serious argument that you can't get there from here in the other direction. People say that Britain actually can't negotiate a way out of the European Union. And if you're a Remainer, that's a cause for great comfort. That despite the efforts of political decision makers you disagree with, this can't happen. The network, the web, holds you tight. I think if you're sceptical about the European Union project for a variety of reasons, the difficulty of getting out of it is one of the reasons why you should. If it is that binding on the way a sovereign state operates, then that in itself is a problem. And Catalonia, of course, may well be driving Korea off the headlines in terms of black swans and big political events needing diplomatic management.
Okay, the final question is just to have you comment briefly on the relationship between Trump and Putin in terms of diplomacy. Questions were phrased a little differently, like what is the interference in our elections? What kind of diplomacy is that? But I don't think it is. But if you could just comment on that relationship briefly, you know.
If there's a tradition, there's a couple of elements of a tradition of United States diplomacy. One is to take what others often regard as a very moral approach, and sometimes a hypocritically moral approach to things like, should we recognize China? When the People's Republic of China was well established and the rest of the world said facts on the ground, it's a reality, those are the people we're going to deal with. And the United States maintained a position to the 1970s of saying the real China is the crowd that we supported who happened to lose the Civil War and maintained their commitment to nationalist China. So there's that moral component. The other part of an American diplomatic tradition is an attraction to symmetry. To let's get the guys who can make the decisions to meet up with each other. Cut out the middlemen, cut out the striped pants cookie cutters, and get right to the people who can deliver. And there's an attraction to that idea. Traditional diplomacy said very often the leaders are idiots. Sometimes when they meet each other, they find they don't like each other, and that gets in the way, and you're better off keeping them apart. I don't know what to say about Putin and Trump in those regards. My instinct would be to say keep them apart.
Tom?
Yeah.
Final words?
Well, and as Paul mentioned, you know, Trump does seem to have a fascination with strong leaders. Mm-hmm. He's expressed admiration for Putin on numerous occasions, and I think... here's where I think the influence of some advisor, potentially Henry Kissinger again. I think what Kissinger is telling Trump is it's dangerous for the United States in terms of U.S. security interests to push China and Russia together into each other's arms. This is something that it really is serious. And therefore, Russia being the weaker party, we need to wean them away from the Chinese. Now, what that means for Ukraine, I mean, basically this kind of a realist outlook would make the free choice of the Ukrainians secondary to some kind of an accommodation with Russia in this larger context. And that's something that the blob, if you will, I mean, Obama coined the term the blob, or people in his White House, for this kind of foreign policy establishment. I think it's pretty a uniform view among a lot of policy experts in the institutes in D.C., that we're not going to make a deal over the heads of the Ukrainians. That's happened all through history in that part of Europe. And we're not about to do that again. In other words, to some extent, the interests of the Ukrainians come ahead of this deteriorating relationship with Russia. So I think, I personally think that Trump has pulled more toward the realist position on this. But the blob is drawing him back. And once again, Congress has acted, has bound his hands on what he can do with Russia with the new set of sanctions. So it's a very complicated, the U.S.-Russian relationship is tragically complicated right now.
This Allworth International Lecture, The Trump Administration and the Future of Diplomacy, was produced at KUMD by Maya Jensen, Cindy Christian, Isaac Herman, Christian Erickson, and Don Schroffnagel. More information and links to this and other Allworth Lecture events at KUMD.org.